Welcome to the Criminal Justice Conversations podcast, a co-production of the Berkeley Center for Criminal Justice and the Berkeley School of Journalism. I'm your host, David Onick. The podcast, recorded weekly in the Berkeley School of Journalism studios, features in-depth interviews with a wide range of criminal justice leaders, law enforcement officials, policymakers, advocates, service providers, academics, and others. The podcast gets behind the soundbites that far too often dominate the public dialogue about criminal justice to have detailed, nuanced conversations about criminal justice policy. Today's guest is Sonny Schwartz, author of Dreams from the Monster Factory, a tale of prison, redemption, and one woman's fight to restore justice for all. Schwartz is a nationally recognized expert on criminal justice reform with over 25 years of hands-on experience in the San Francisco criminal justice system. Schwartz and her colleagues created the Resolve to Stop the Violence Project, or RSVP, an internationally recognized, award-winning restorative justice program that brings together traditionally opposing groups in order to comprehensively confront the costs of violence. An evaluation of RSVP determined that participants who were in the program for 4 months had a violent crime rearrest rate 80% lower than those in a control group. RSVP earned a prestigious Innovations in American Government Award from Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and has been featured on The Oprah Winfrey Show, Larry King Live, and PBS. Schwartz also helped establish the first charter high school in the nation for incarcerated adults. She joins me today in the studio. Sonny Schwartz, welcome to the program.
Hi, David. I'm delighted to be here.
Sonny, you've established some of the most innovative jail programming in the country. Before we discuss that, I want to understand what the San Francisco jails were like prior to the establishment of these programs. What did the inmates do all day?
Well, good question. What the inmates did all day then and what many, if not the vast majority of inmates do across our country is they sleep all day, play cards and dominoes, and watch terrible TV like Jerry Springer or cartoons, and at that time lifting weights or watered-down bleach bottles and making homemade weapons or homemade brew called Pruno, and they basically rotted away daily and never taken the time to look in the mirror and try to figure out how they can stop their painful behavior to themselves and others. So really, hence the name of my book is Monster Factory. You put like-minded people together in an open dormitory or a long traditional tier that there are 80, 90, 100 people on that cell block. And, you know, we scratch our heads wondering why people keep getting arrested over and over again. They sit and rot and stew all day long. So under the leadership of Michael Hennessy, we started to really look at how we can use our jails as a place of change and reform and investing in people's success.
So where did you start in that process, and what did you feel was missing from the original programming that you started?
Okay, good question. Well, I started just from some context here is I started as a law student in 1980. I wanted to be a criminal defense attorney. Possibly many reasons. As a youth in Chicago, I saw too many kids in my class being plucked out for status offenses or more egregious offenses. So my roots really were in criminal justice, and I needed to put myself through law school, and I also needed – I went to a public interest law school that I needed 900-plus hours of internship. So the county jail prisoner legal service program was available to me, and when I walk the tiers, David, as I do today even, I saw the most paradoxical situation, the most, the despair of the human spirit as well as the tremendous potential. So my career completely changed, as I write about painfully in the book, when I met a child molester. And he was about to get released, and I won't go through that painful story. But the essence of that was he was about to get released. He was screaming for help in his very damaged way and promised that he was going to reoffend. And in fact, he did. And that really changed the whole trajectory of my career. I went out and practiced law. Mike Hennessy asked me if I would come back and be his program administrator about 1990 because we were opening up yet another jail. And he wanted to do things different. He didn't want to just warehouse people. He wanted it to turn into a program facility. Well, frankly, I never had any experience in administration. I was trained as a lawyer, as an advocate. But I was very intrigued by it. And the first thing we did was hire a learning specialist. And we, 360 prisoners at that time, we had education testing. We had one-on-one interviews. And the demographics were, we expected, it was still very shocking. 80% disclosed that they had a drug or alcohol problem. 75% tested between a fourth and seventh grade reading level. 90% were parents, whether they were custodial or non-custodial parents. 90% disclosed that they were victims of violence, perpetrators of violence, or both. And majority of women, more than a majority, I would say close to 100%, were victims of child sexual trauma. When I was a law student, David, in 1980, today I'm seeing the grandchildren. We're talking about third generations just in my tenure. Actually, I'm close to 30 years in the business. So this was a call to action. So we provided classes. Skyline College at that time, our next-door neighbors out at the San Bruno complex, provided about 12 classes. We provided parenting. We provided, 90% never held a legal job for more than a year. So we provided all that. And it was really very heartening. For the first time, people were passing tests. The pride and the dignity was rising. However, people kept coming back over and over and over again, sometimes 5, 6, 10 times, as shocking as it is, within a year. So it was fortuitous, the timing. And I'm going to get to the answering your question. It was, the timing was fortuitous in that I was at a conference in Minnesota, and I heard about this concept called restorative justice. See, what we were doing before was rehabilitation, which is so important, not to minimize that, but there were missing links. Where was the voice of those who've been hurt? Where was the voice of the community who's been traumatized? Where was the accountability of those who hurt people? This conference in Minnesota was about a variety of things. I heard about this concept from a colleague who went to a workshop by a woman by the name of Kay Prannis, who is known as the godmother of restorative justice. I looked at this pamphlet and went good and crazy. And it simply said that restorative justice recognizes that crime hurts everyone, victim, offender, community, and it creates an obligation to make things right. To answer your question, the programs that we started were really important, but there were missing links, as I just said.
Well, you not only answered my first question, you anticipated my next question about restorative justice, so I appreciate you going there. So you decided to start a program based on restorative justice principles, and that's what became the RSVP program. One of the things you did from the beginning was invite all the key stakeholders to the table to plan for the program. You planned for over a year, and as you put it, you wanted everyone I can think of who had a stake in violence in our communities to be on board. So that included victims, sheriff's deputies, probation officers, district attorneys, police, business leaders, and former offenders. Some of your colleagues thought you were crazy to try to bring all these people together. Why was it so important to you to have such a diverse range of stakeholders involved in the planning?
Really important. I'm glad you brought this up, and I want to underscore that. As in any community, there's the us, them. There are, in criminal justice, it's the victims, the offenders. It's the correctional officers and deputy sheriffs against the civilians. Restorative justice really brings it all together and does a magical and important job of including everyone. And that is, I think, the key, you should pardon the expression, the key to the universe. Everyone has a stake in this. Everyone who's listening to this podcast, everyone who walking on the campus, everyone in any synagogue or temple or mosque or up in Pleasanton, there's virtually no degree of separation when it comes to crime, whether we know it or not. The Pew study comes out, 1 in 3 people have some criminal justice contact, whether it is parole, probation, incarceration. That's not even including victims, whether your car was ripped off or your bike was ripped off to something much more egregious. So I thought, and many of us shared that, and thankfully Sheriff Hennessy's leadership allowed us to really explore this. We did something very risky on the face of it. we brought in Republicans and Democrats, people for and against the death penalty, people for and against three strikes. It was nerve-wracking, don't get me wrong, because we didn't want this combustion and totally go south on it. But we kept our eye on the prize, and the prize was this. We didn't have the luxury to talk about faith, God or no God, or three strikes, because every single man in our custody was getting out into everybody's community. So we had this eye on the prize, if you will, of how one mission, how to stop violence in our homes, in our community. And we never, it was actually an 18-month process. We had Jean O'Hara, who was the victim of the most horrific. Her son, grandson and daughter were brutally murdered, sitting next to Hussein, who was a former gang member in L.A. and undoubtedly hurt people, who was sitting next to Lizanius, who also created havoc in his neighborhood, who was sitting next to a feminist who was committed to make sure that domestic violence perpetrators were behind bars. Very strange bedfellows, but we all shared the common goal was stopping violence, and that's what we kept our eye on.
And you facilitated these meetings with all these folks?
I did. Sometimes it was like trying to bridle wild horses in some ways. But we never disintegrated. We never went off into
by keeping your eye on the ball of that focus.
Exactly right. And that's the key, is that we don't have the, and we don't today have the luxury to talk about and argue. Three strikes is a failure. We know that. I was just on the floor at the county jail. There's a young woman in our custody. Her third strike, or actually it's her fourth strike, she broke into a warehouse. She's looking at 25 to life. Who benefits from that? That's absurd. Don't get me wrong. I'm an abolitionist of how we do, how we approach crime and punishment. I'm not an abolitionist. I think some people should never see the light of day. I want to be real clear about that.
And you make that very clear in your book, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
Let me turn back to one of the key figures, really, on the committee that planned this and then in the actual program. And you mentioned her, Jean O'Hara. Jean founded Survivors of Murder Victims, as you said, after her daughter and grandson were murdered in a horrible crime.
Yeah.
And she's working to keep any other families from having to suffer as she did. The passage in your book where you describe when she first talked to the program participants about her daughter and grandson's death was extremely powerful. I had already heard it before, and I was almost in tears when I read it.
Yeah.
What did she tell these violent men?
Well, also some background, too, and I'll tell you what she told them. Jean lived in the East Bay, in a suburb in the East Bay, and also was is a pro-death penalty believer, and was really reluctant to. She was like, "What is this gathering? I'm sitting next to these people I've never even thought of sitting next to." But once she heard our commitment and our no-nonsense approach about accountability, she started relaxing, and it was healing for her because she founded that Parents and Friends of Murder Victims and Survivors of Murder Victims. Because she wanted, out of respect of her lost loved ones, to carry on their name in some public interest venture. She ended up being the coordinator for our Survivor Impact, which happens every Wednesday in RSVP, where victims of crime comes in and tells their story. Is a way of engendering to foster empathy with the men in our program. Her first time on the floor, she brought pictures of her murdered daughter and grandson, and told the story, sentence by sentence, word by word, of what it was like when she woke up and she had this horrible feeling in the pit of her heart because she didn't hear from her daughter, and step by step what it was like to go to her house to find them in pools of blood and the aftermath of the trial and the horrific healing, you know, the horror of it all and the healing that took many, many years and is ongoing. And she talked to the men, looked each of them in the eye, shook their hand, and said, "If I did my job right and I prevented one of you from doing the same thing that was done to our family, I did my job." And that's what that's about. It's about not shame, but about empathy.
What was the reaction of the men in that room?
There was not a dry eye. many of the, you know, criminal justice, traditional criminal justice does not lend itself to introspection and empathy, let alone, you know, many of the men don't even, and women who have offended, don't even know the names of their victims. So this is about bringing dignity for those who survived, for those who have been hurt, as well as creating an environment where it underscores the men's humanity and potential humanity. And there wasn't a dry eye in there. And there was a lot of gratitude. And you ask a lot of the men today, you know, what impact them? And they will, a lot of times they'll talk about Gene.
So the victim impact statement is a key part of the program. Can you talk about some of the other key components like the peer education piece?
Sure. We have three major components in RSVP. Dr. Gilligan notes, I mean, the evaluation was dramatic to us. We were delightfully surprised. We're still not satisfied, to tell you the truth. When anyone's satisfied what they're doing in criminal justice and saying this is the answer, I think you got to run the other way. This is a real complex situation. But we're really heartened and encouraged by our accomplishments. Both are true. We have three major components. The victim-survivor impact that we just described. We also work with we reach out to all the survivors of the RSVP perpetrator prisoners, providing them emotional and practical support. We have another core component called Man Alive. Man Alive originally was a batterer's intervention because half of our men are domestic violence perpetrators, the other half are random violence. Man Alive started as a domestic violence batterer's intervention, and they were able to adapt the curriculum to include random. It's a very intensive peer-based program which works with, it's an educational program that works with the change of attitudes, beliefs, and behaviors that fuel male role violence. And I say male role because we are raised with certain sexual stereotypes. Men are raised not inherently violent, but taught who's superior, who's inferior, the expectation of services, and it comes out oftentimes that we see in violence, whether it's emotional, sexual, physical. Hamish Sinclair was the founder of Man Alive, and it has done enormous amount of work shifting. They go through a very intensive thing called a destruction cycle, frame by frame of what led to that violent incident. And then there's a reversal of an assertion cycle. And it's all led by formerly abusive men. Very, very powerful. Because those men who were facilitating were once sitting in an orange down on the floor of the jail. So needless to say, there's a lot more credibility. There's very little wiggle room, too, with justifying, denying violence. It's a very powerful.
And you describe one of those sessions very clearly in the book. I think a reader really does get a sense of what it would be like to be there and participating in a session like that.
I hope so. If I did my job right, I hope that people get that. But it's the combination of the violence, the Man Alive survivor impact, and we also have a community theater component, which is role-playing as well as talk about standing in the shoes. Some play the victim, some play the perpetrator, and Community Works is our founder and provider of that initiative. It's a multimodal approach, which Dr. Gilligan underscored that was the key to the success.
Can you give us an example of a program success story that really stands out in your mind, one individual?
The good news, there's several, so let me think of more than several. It's interesting. I just got a call on my way here. There's a man in the book that I describe. His name is Ben. He's a neo-Nazi skinhead. And he is an ongoing success, and he's struggling. And that's the thing that we need to be real frank about. There's nothing simple or easy about this. When someone relapses, when someone reoffends, it's horrifying. It's disappointing. However, that's all the more reason to amp up these programs. I call Ben. He has another name, his real name. He called me just now. He hasn't been rearrested. He created havoc beat up gay people, black folks, and Jewish folks. Biggest racist you ever want to meet. And he went through our program. We mandated him. K- kicking and screaming. And he ended up teaching other men how to stop their violence. He's still struggling. He hasn't been rearrested, but he still struggles with alcohol and drugs. And that's a real that's another call to action, how we need to make sure we have those safety nets on the outside. I can name numerous, we have several successes. All of our facilitators, gangbangers, who just really tortured people, tormented the neighborhoods, who are now facilitators. Every one of our facilitators right now were tax drainers, let alone beating up their partners, beating up people in the neighborhood. They're now teaching other men how to stop their violence. And survivors who are able, when I walk out my door, because the survivor services is right in my area in the office, and I see women coming in, down and out, beat up, and then a month later I see them just checking in with their kids, vibrant, walking tall. Those are successes. That makes it all worthwhile.
I want to turn now to one of the darkest days in the history of the program, the day you learned that Tari Ramirez, a recent program participant, had killed his ex-girlfriend with a butcher knife in front of her children. What went through your mind when you heard that news?
It was horrifying. It was, on so many levels, it was horrifying because our survivor service staff worked with Claire Tempanko. And many of the facilitators worked with Tari Ramirez, the offender, the perpetrator. David, it was really one of the darkest times of RSVP. I put it in the book because we have to be, I insist that we be very frank and honest about this. There's no magic pill here. Tari was in our program on and off, I think, for 4 months. There's a lot to be said about how the system failed, but ultimately this man failed. He was the perpetrator. We provide an opportunity. But when I walked in that day and saw everyone's face, you know, really down and out, and they told me, I immediately gathered all the staff together because people were crying their eyes out and their hearts out. It was very personal to them, as well as the horrific loss and thinking about those kids who witnessed their mom being brutally murdered. What happened was that Tari got out and he... As you said, he brutally murdered his ex-girlfriend. And a lot of folks, a lot of the facilitators were like, what are we doing? I guess this doesn't work. And I don't like to make cheap analogies, but I really believe in my heart and my mind, it's not about what we did wrong. It was about what he did wrong. And we had to remind each other that even with chemotherapy, someone's going to die. Does that mean we stop experimenting or stop trial and success, trial and failure? No. I think it just amps it up that much more. The accountability piece, there was a lot of problems with him him missing in probation. I'm not pointing blame. My point is that we all have a responsibility, first and foremost, this perpetrator, but we all have a responsibility.
What did you learn about the program itself that could be improved from that particular incident?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think the biggest thing is our reentry services and our integrating more drug and alcohol counseling within our violence prevention program. But there has to be, and we can't do it just the Sheriff's Department, but every single criminal justice arm as well as community-based organizations, there cannot be any wiggle room with particularly violent offenders. Do not pass go. There has to be very strict accountability and reentry services. I frankly think, you know, people are on probation for 3 years on a case-by-case basis to really look at how to turn some of those hotels downtown into vibrant, no-nonsense residential treatment, depending on what their issues are, from drugs to violence to drug prepare, and ankle bracelets, GPS. I think that we have a lot to learn from and utilize from our technology, and no wiggle room with that missing in action stuff.
Let me ask you about the policy implications of your work. So much of criminal justice policy is stuck in an ideological stalemate between tough on crime versus soft on crime, punishment versus rehabilitation. But RSVP really gets beyond these labels and appeals to all the varied stakeholders in the system. RSVP is tough on offenders, and it rehabilitates them. You write in the book that voters have been happy to spend money on jails and prisons, but not on anything to keep these men out of jail. How can RSVP, with its broad base of support, help change that?
Yeah, wonderful area to talk about. This whole concept of tough on crime is such a fiction. I happen to think RSVP is the toughest on crime because you talk to nobody wants to look themselves in the eye and really, really look at what they've done.
In fact, in the book, many of the offenders say, I don't want to do this. I just want to do my time and watch TV. This is too hard. I don't want to be involved in this.
That's exactly right. I mean, coddling prisoners. I think the traditional approach is coddling prisoners. I don't mean to minimize that jail is a cakewalk, but the point, a traditional jail, who gets to sleep all day and watch TV and have their breakfast, lunch, and dinner served to them, albeit terrible food, but nonetheless, you get the concept. That's coddling. What we're doing is mandating, and I want to underscore that, a lot of the men in the program do not volunteer. It's about maybe, I don't know if it's half and half these days, but it's mandated. It's a policy of the Sheriff's Department. You hurt yourself or your partner or your neighbors, you're going into RSVP. And they, as you said, they're kicking and screaming, get me the heck out of here. I just want to do my time and sleep it off. Well, that's not tough on crime because they're virtually all getting out. You know, 90% of them are getting out into your neighborhood and mine. So how to bridge this gap and this fiction? I think it's about the political and social will. It's not about, and a lot of times people say, we can't afford this now. Baloney. We can't afford not to do this. For every dollar spent, so many studies say that we save the taxpayer $6 to $7 for every dollar spent. How does RSVP bridge it? Well, ironically, it's being replicated more outside the country than in the country, and I'm not sure why. And I, you know, we can talk a little bit about that if time permits. Singapore has replicated part of it, the Man Alive program. Poland, Mexico, the governor of Mexico, many officials came up. We have replicated in Westchester County. We had a county executive saying, "Let's do it. This is our county is being overrun with violence. Let's do it." We'll figure out the way to do it. So it's not a matter of new money. It's about redirecting existing money.
Well, let me ask you about replication because, you know, the program really, frankly, seems better suited to prisons than jails. You happen to work in the jail, and right. You usually have participants for 4 to 5 months. They're either awaiting trial or serving short sentences typically. You say in the book that you'd prefer to have them for 2 years. In prison, they're there for longer. You don't have a longer time to work with them. We had Matthew Cate, the secretary of the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, on the program a few weeks ago, right. And he talked about the importance of rehabilitation programs that research has proven to work. RSVP certainly seems to fit into that category, so I'm wondering if you've talked to California corrections officials at all about replicating RSVP in California's prisons.
Yeah. Again, good question. We have. They've reached out to us about our charter school because we have the first of the kind in the nation of a charter high school for adult offenders and incarcerated. The governor sent his strike team. This is, I think, before Matthew's tenure, down to see our programs. And I thought something was going to happen from that. We're here to share whatever recipe we have. This is not we will dance in the street to help. Sheriff Hennessey is extremely generous with allowing his staff to work with other jurisdictions. So I'm here to say, call us, whether it's California or New York, but certainly in our own backyard, we really need a lot of work. We're not saying we have the answer, but we have a very, very promising, credible approach, and we're happy to help.
We have time for a couple quick last questions. My first one involves the relationship between the sheriff's deputies and the prison service workers. You talk about this a lot in the book. Of course, you came in as a prison legal service worker, and your attitude towards the sheriff really was that they were the enemy as mm-hmm. you walked in. Mm-hmm. As the book reveals, some sheriff's deputies were absolutely key in the success of the RSVP program, and you come to realize and write about eloquently that really there are sheriff's deputies who are very committed and hardworking, and there are sheriff's deputies who are just punching the clock. Mm-hmm. They're, at the same time, they're prison service workers who are passionate about what they're doing and hardworking, and others who are just punching the clock. How did your sense of the relationship between the sworn and the civilian staff there develop over time?
David, you really read the book. That's impressive. Thank you. No, you hit it. You hit it on the nose. Like any other organization, like any other work community, there are people who are collecting a paycheck and there are people who are not. And I have to admit, as I disclose in there, I participated in the yes-them. But as time went on and emotional physics developed, you got to know people. And the bottom line is the deputy sheriffs are really hardworking men and women who want to do a good job. They really want to do a good job. They want to go home at night, not wasted, not filled with hate. Let's stipulate there's a percentage that who are into abuse of power, without a doubt. But I'm talking about, again, the vast majority of the men and women want to do a good, noble job. We found, and that's the beauty of restorative justice, is including everyone once again. We found that people were saying, like, for instance, we started acupuncture therapy years ago for substance abusing men and women. It started in New York by a medical doctor. Some of the deputies were outraged. What is this, bringing needles in? But when we did a demonstration with them and they found a positive effect, we made sure that we had office hours for deputy sheriffs to avail themselves of that service. When you engage when we had deputy sheriffs part of creating a program, it's basic human instinct and nature. You're going to be much more committed to something that you create, and there's going to be a sense of pride and dignity. P.S., RSVP, people were really concerned that it was going to be the most dangerous. You don't put 62 violent offenders in an open dormitory. It defies conventional wisdom. It turns out to be one of the most safe and contextually tranquil dorms where there is virtually no officer assaults compared to others in the traditional jail. So we really needed to hear the voice of those with uniforms saying, you know what, we don't want to coddle prisoners. Why don't you include us? We have a lot to say. And they were like, yes. We had to humble ourselves and say, you're right. So when we engage them, it is a natural partnership. We can't have safety and security without programs, and we can't have programs without safety and security. It's a natural marriage. And I vigorously argue the same at CDCR, is that to engage the COs, despite the reputation that they're the largest lobby and they don't want to do this.
COs, you mean correctional officers.
Correctional office, thank you. Is that I think that they, as well as all of us, are yearning to do the right thing and yearning to contribute to our society.
A final question. I want to come back to something you brought up at the beginning of our conversation about a man named Fred Johnson, or at least he's called Fred Johnson mm-hmm. in the book, who is a pedophile who is getting out of jail and basically told you, I'm going to reoffend. This is who my victim is going to be. And you, he was getting out in a week. He said, I've been here for a year and I haven't gotten any help at all. You went and talked to the sheriff, the judge, the public defender, the probation officer. And some were more helpful than others. But for all of them, they were doing their job, but none of their jobs was to deal with this situation.
That's
right. As you wrote, I had to wonder whose job it was to fight for justice, to try to do what was best for everyone. It was no one's job. And then you talk about this concept of true defense, how you had come in wanting to be a public defender, but you came to see for you personally what the limits of that would be and that you wanted to practice what you called true defense. So can you talk about what true defense is and how this particular incident led to you wanting to work in that way?
Yeah, that's a whole other conversation, but I know it's important to cover. So when I was the law intern, his confession that he's a child molester and he was about to repeat that crime and just rang in my heart. And when I went to talk to his defense attorney, and please, folks out there listening and just for our own integrity, I am not knocking criminal defense attorneys. They are, thank God for them. But when I went to her and she was sickened by his confession and called him a couple choice words, she just immediately went into, but don't mess with his release date because it is my job to give him a zealot representation, be a zealot advocate. And she said, we're not social workers, Sonny. And she was right, we're not social workers. And I heard that my entire career from everybody. However, true defense, I kept saying to her, true defense is making sure that this man gets the services so he doesn't get killed on the outside, kill someone else, and he's back here for life. Well, that's a pie in the sky concept, and that was, you know, circa 1983. It wasn't her fault because the judge did the same, the DA did the same, and this probation officer, this very heroic probation officer, was really trying to do the right thing. So glory be the day that we all get together like we do in Judge Morgan's court, for instance, behavioral health court. We all get together, put down our armor, and talk about the best interest of that individual and our society and that individual's victim. What a concept to bring everyone together, for those victims particularly who want to, and come up with a very airtight approach to making sure this man doesn't create havoc on people again. And that's what I mean by true defense.
And that is a great way to end. Sonny Schwartz, thanks so much for joining us. And let me just note that Dreams of the Monster Factory was just released in paperback. It's available at Amazon.com and in bookstores across the country. Thanks again.
My pleasure. Thank you, David.
Please tune in next week when we'll be joined by Senator Mark Leno, chair of the California Senate Public Safety Committee. Thank you for listening to the Criminal Justice Conversations podcast. You can find this episode of the podcast and all prior episodes on our website at www.law.berkeley.edu/CJConversations. You can also become a fan of the Criminal Justice Conversations podcast on Facebook. The podcast is engineered by Milt Wallace. Our editor is Callie Schoenfeld, and our program intern is Eve Ekman. I'm David Onick. Thanks for listening.